This week marks the release of a DVD box set of the first season of the Smurf cartoon show 27 years ago. This year marks the creation of the Smurfs for a Belgian comic strip called Johan and Peewit 50 years ago. The Society of Blue Beings was created by the cartoonist known as Peo for a one-time appearance, but in this case, the bit parts overshadowed the stars and earned their own comic, their own action figures, and finally, their own long-running TV show in the U.S. Legend has it that the show was born in 1980 when an NBC program exec was walking with his daughter in a mall and she cried out for a Smurf doll. Thus was born the first animated network series inspired by a toy. Yes, it was the first, says Heather Hendershot, a professor of media studies at Queen's College, but it was by no means the worst.
On He-Man or She-Ra or Thundercats, the toy executives would create, say, a new vehicle or a new weapon, and then they would tell the cartoonists, incorporate this into a storyline. And with Smurfs, the stories weren't centered around new products or new toys. They were centered around a kind of interpersonal relationships, things that made parents happy, made the Emmy people happy. So it was this kind of warm, fuzzy, softer way of selling toys.
Long, long ago, deep in the forest, there was a hidden village where tiny creatures lived. They called themselves Smurfs. They were good.
The Smurfs were each identified by a single trait. Hefty Smurf, Farmer Smurf, Brainy, Handy, Greedy, Grouchy, and Clumsy Smurf, presided over by the 542-year-old Papa Smurf, all living harmoniously together in a village of mushroom cottages. Among the unsolved mysteries, how many were there? Why were there no girl Smurfs? And most mysterious of all, why were they so popular?
There's a lot of reason and there's no reason.
Thierry Califord is the son of the cartoonist known as Peo.
I think the popularity of the Smurf is because they are cute, because they are blue, that's original, because they are small, and when you were a kid, you loved a story about world that's smaller than you. Another thing, everybody knows a greedy, a brainy, or a jockey Smurf. Maybe it's yourself, and then everybody can recognize himself or his community in the Smurf village and then in the Smurf adventure.
Well, I think you probably hit on something there with the sort of recognition factor. You know, you have Hefty Smurf and Handy Smurf and Brainy Smurf.
Yeah.
And you have Papa Smurf, who some people say bore a suspicious likeness to Karl Marx.
Yeah, yeah. And they say my father was part of the Communist Party in the 50s, and the Smurfs is the apology of the communism world. And, of course, that's the reason why Papa Smurf had a big white bird like Karl Marx, and he has a red bonnet and a red pants. It was very funny because my father wasn't interested in politics at all.
Did the blue Smurfs pose a red menace? The idea caught on among a few critics and students in the early 90s, and when you think about it, there was a certain pinkness to the Smurf political economy, a from each according to his own ability to each according to his need kind of thing. More persistent, though, were the charges of sexism. There were no girls in Smurf Village until one is cooked up in a cauldron by the evil Gargamel to seduce and destroy. Yeesh.
This magical lump of blue clay will become the first female Smurf. A beautiful but evil Smurf to lead all the others straight to me.
After Smurfette nearly destroys the Smurf village, Papa Smurf takes her into his cottage, which doubles as a lab, and makes some alterations. Along with eradicating her dark side, he makes her a blonde and magically supplies a prettier dress and high-heeled shoes. In short, Smurfette becomes an upstanding member of Smurf Village when she becomes Barbie.
Yeah, exactly. It was a cliché, you know, the poor little girl with the black hair and nobody wants to look at her, and she felt pretty alone. And then Papa Smurf decided to transform her into a bimbo.
Heather Hendershot.
In some myths, the creation of woman is deeply sort of sexist, and in other more maternally centered cultures is less sexist. And that clearly sounds like a sexist creation myth. There's just nothing really positive you can get out of that, right?
The Smurfs may forever remain a pop culture mystery. Look online at the discussions of the upcoming Smurf movie, and you'll find lots of potty-mouthed spewing about the Smurfs and numerous X-rated aspirations with regard to Smurfette. That's usual for the net, but it surprised me just the same that a product so bland could spark reactions so intense. It wouldn't have surprised the United Nations, or at least UNICEF. A few years ago, it produced a 30-second commercial pitching peace. Specifically, it was intended to jolt the Belgian public into supporting fundraising efforts for ex-child soldiers in Africa. Now, usually when UNICEF is trying to raise money for children, it uses images of real children. But this time, it used Smurfs. Happy Smurfs going about their happy business until their village is carpet bombed, leaving the Smurfs hysterical, bloodied, and dead. Thierry Culliford.
And everybody in the world saw this animated cartoon, and everybody was shocked. And a few days later, the people say, you were right, we have a big problem in our civilization right now, that we were more shocked to see a Smurf wounded than a real child wounded. Maybe a Smurf is closer, I don't know why.
Queen's College professor Heather Hendershot doubts that people are less moved by images of real dead children than dead Smurfs, but she can see why they would shock.
I think it's shocking to see any image that you grew up with, that's mythical, that's close to you, whether it's Bugs Bunny or the Smurfs or My Little Pony or whatever, to see that image in some way degraded or changed or attacked. You know, Disney seems to control every image it's created. How could Mickey Mouse suddenly be smoking a joint on YouTube? You know, it seems impossible. When you see a corruption of this corporate-controlled image, it seems so strange.
The Smurfs, created in mid-20th century Belgium, have been remarkably resistant to change over the decades. But the new movie, or rumored trilogy slated for release this year, will make use not only of high-tech computer-generated imagery, the Smurfs will reportedly appear in 3D. Whether that will apply to their characters is an altogether different question. It could be harder to swallow the idea of a Smurf with a 3D personality than a Smurf smoking a joint, or even a Smurf flattened by a bomb.
Smurf along with me. Simple as can be.
Next time you're feeling blue, just let a smile begin. Happy things will come to you.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Paul Schneider and Zach Marsh. We also had help from Nadia Zonis, Sasha Evans, and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.